Okay, so in describing particle systems, we have the particles p sub I. Each has a mass m sub I. And we use these other variables, x, capital X, to stand for their position in space. So this is three-dimensional space, so this would actually be have three components, the xy, lowercase x, y, and z component of three-dimensional space. And now, then we have the first derivative of the position with respect to time is the velocity. And of course, the first derivative of velocity with respect to time is acceleration. So we have variables v sub I and a sub I to stand for the quantities velocity and acceleration, respectively. So that sets up what are the quantities that we're dealing with in a particle system. And now we want to describe how the particles move, how they interact in the system. And so we're going to set up some equations. And these are set up according to Newton's laws. This is the first law, the law of gravitation. It says that, so how the particles move will be affected by, first we'll set up the quantity force, which each particle is affected by the force acting on it by the other particles. So you can see in the diagram that there is a particle 3, and it's going to have a force acting on it from each of the other particles, m1, m2, and m4. So the equation at the upper part of the slide describes this force. The force, and I'm sorry, these subscripts are a little hard to read, but it says force sub ij, and that's the force on particle I that is due to particle j. So this force equation expresses for each pair of particles I and j the force between them. So it's first of all g, the gravitational constant, times the mass of particle I times the mass of particle j, times this quantity involving the distance between the particles. So we first take x sub j minus x sub I, and then we divide it by the cube of the Euclidean distance r sub I j. So that expresses the force between all the particles according to Newton's first law. So after that, we can use Newton's second law, the equations of motion, to use the force to describe the motion. So Newton's second law says that force is equal to mass times acceleration, and we can use that to derive an equation for acceleration in our equation system. So we assume we have the n particles, and we're using the same notation. The positions x are x1 through xn, velocities v1 through vn, accelerations a1 through an. And then we have the equation that velocity is the first derivative of x with respect to time, and acceleration then is the first derivative of velocity. But we can compute acceleration according to Newton's second law by observing that the acceleration is related to force by dividing by the mass of the particle in question. So the acceleration of particle I is the gravitational constant times the sum of the part that we got from the forces of all the other particles of the mass of the other particle m sub j times this quantity involving the distances that we talked about on the previous slide. So this is the acceleration from the forces due to Newtonian mechanics. Notice that other particle systems will have other force laws. For example, molecular dynamics, when talking about the forces between two particles, would have inverse distance factors with higher coefficients. So there's an r to the sixth factor there and an r to the tenth factor. So that's an example of how such equations arise in particle systems that we're familiar with, like the solar system, where Newtonian mechanics apply. And now we want to talk about how to solve such equations. So essentially what we have is, if you look at the diagram on slide 8, is the curvy, the wavy red line is supposed to describe the path of a particle. And this is the function that we're trying to solve for. We don't know this function. What we do know is how the first derivative and the second derivative of this function behave. That's what we have equations for. So how can you solve for these? Well, actually, if they, and how do you know if they even have a solution depending on what the equation you have? Well, for these equations, in order to solve them, you set up two different cases based on what the essentially boundary conditions are. And the first are called initial value problems. And for initial value problems, you are given an initial position for the quantity you're trying to solve for. So if it's x position, you're given an initial position x0. And then you know, of course, the first derivative of that position. And so you keep, you want to solve for the next position and so on, keep solving until you actually trace out the path of the curve of the function that you're trying to solve. Boundary value problems are a little different because you're given endpoints and in order to solve the equation, two different points. Now, if these equations, some of these equations can be solved by analytical methods, particularly if they're linear equations. But if they're nonlinear equations, things which involve more complicated coefficients than simple coefficients, then you may have to use numerical techniques such as we're going to describe. So first, we're going to start here on page 9 to talk about how to set up these systems of equations so that they can be solved numerically. So first of all, we wrote down our particle system of equations as two first-order equations. We said velocity was the first derivative of position and acceleration was the first derivative of velocity. So actually, though, we could have written down acceleration is the second derivative of x of position with respect to time. And that's what this upper equation says. But just like we so in general, when you're trying to solve systems of ODEs, you may have these so-called second-order equations, equations involving the second derivative. But you can always rewrite these, as we did for the equations of motion, by introducing a variable to stand for the first derivative and expressing it as the first derivative of x, and then having the quantity A be the first derivative of that variable. So for us, for equations of motion, that variable that we introduced was, in fact, the velocity. So that can be done for any systems of equations. So typically, we're going to talk about solving systems of equations that are first order, because we can convert higher order equations to first order equations. Now, also for simplicity, when we discuss how to solve these equations, in general, we're going to have a system of equations with more than one, but we'll just discuss one equation as we go, and it turns out to be that you just apply the techniques that we'll discuss to each of the equations to solve the entire system. So we'll just talk about solving one equation at a time. So the form of the equations that we had was we had the derivative of some quantity like x with respect to a variable t, for us that was position and time, but now we're thinking more generally about any variable x with respect to any quantity x with respect to the variable t. And then on the right hand side we would have some equation, some function in terms of x and t. And so the right hand side is the function that expresses the value of the derivative function. So f is going to be the first derivative function in all the succeeding slides here that talk about these techniques. Now we're going to solve this, solve for this continuous function by setting up a numerical grid of points, and we're going to iterate from one position to the next. That is, we're going to iterate over time to keep finding successive values of the function. So we're going to discuss here setting up, also setting up equidistant points. So we're assuming that we're going to have some endpoints, capital A and capital B, of the interval we're trying to solve. We want to divide it into n intervals. And so each interval will have size h. And h is defined to be the difference between the endpoints b minus a divided by n, the number of intervals that we're solving over. So in the diagram down below, we'll think about calculating the initial position and then going over, setting up this grid of intervals T0, T1, T2, T3, so that video came back. Can we please not have that video popping up, unless you need it for test purposes. Okay, so here on slide 10, we're going to start with the initial value x0. The intervals that we've set up of size h are going to be represented by the variable at various positions, t0, t1, and so on, and we will iterate over these small intervals of the variable t in order to approximate the function in a numerical way. So one of the first questions we should ask is this going to work? That is, can we really start at one end with an initial value and keep approximating the next value of the function and expect to actually compute the function with any kind of accuracy? So, of course, it's very important to be also calculating the error in these numerical approximations. So, first of all, there is a source of error that we might call computational error that is just includes such thing as round off in the computation, and in general we'll consider that that can be solved by regular computing means by making sure that we are having enough digits in our values to so that the computer arithmetic is computing a significant result. But the error that concerns us here is the discretization error. That is, what is the error that's introduced by our doing these numerical approximations over these intervals in a discrete way, as opposed to actually being able to analytically compute the continuous function over the interval in question, over the entire interval. So there are two measures. The first is called global error, and at any point we can think about the error between the solution that we've approximated, I'm sorry, the approximation that we've computed and the true solution. The problem with this is that it's usually pretty difficult to compute this global error because we need to compare our numerical approximation with the true solution, and if we knew the true solution, then we wouldn't be approximating it in the first place. So this is very difficult or expensive to even to estimate. So what people typically do is compute local error instead, and that's the difference between the solution and the numerical approximation over one time step. And so this is turns out to be proportional to the difference between the approximations that you've made, and it's much easier to calculate, and it indirectly indicates global error, and we'll talk about that when we're talking about when we're analyzing the error for some of the techniques that we're doing. So now on page 12, we'll discuss the first numerical technique to approximate the value of one of these ordinary differential equations. And this is called Euler's method. It's sometimes referred to as one of the Runge-Kutta methods, or sometimes as one of the Taylor methods. These are a class of methods that we're going to discuss first, ending with the method that's the traditional classical Runge-Kutta method. It's one of these methods. So Euler's method is really pretty easy. That is, so first of all, let's set up what we're talking about with these time intervals. So we know the interval size between each of the t sub i's in the time dimension is supposed to be h. So we can in fact compute each t sub I as the initial t0 plus h times I over the entire interval. And the entire interval will be the value of the last t sub last minus t sub 0 over h. So that relates the values of the t sub i's as they occur over the interval. So now we can say we start with an initial value x0, and for each value x sub I plus 1, we will approximate it by taking the value of x sub I and adding to it h times the derivative function. So remember that the derivative function f was something expressed in terms of t and x, and expressed the first derivative of the function that we're trying to compute. So essentially what this amounts to, you can see in the diagram on the right, is that we start with the initial value x0. We can compute the first derivative of this position, so that would be f of t0 x0, and that's the slope of the curve of the function we're trying to compute. So we just take a linear extrapolation, that is, we multiply by h times the derivative, and that gives us the increment that we're guessing that this function makes over the first interval. And that's h times the value of the derivative. And we add that onto the previous value, x0, to get our next value, x1, and we continue doing that. So this is not practical, but it illustrates the technique. It's just using the derivative to get a linear approximation of the next point. So why do we say this isn't a practical technique? Well, in order to do that, let's try to analyze the amount of error that we would get in Euler's method. And this will be also illustrate the way in which error is analyzed for these equations. We're not going to explicitly analyze the error for all of them because it's quite complex, but this is will illustrate the technique. So on slide 13, we have written down the Taylor's theorem for a representation of the solution, which we're the exact solution we're calling capital Y. We're using capital X for the approximate solutions that we're computing. And Taylor's theorem, if you remember from your calculus, we all met Taylor's theorem in calculus, right? And so people describe it as representing the neighborhood around a point in terms of the derivatives of the function. So here the point that we're looking at is the point t sub I. So we're looking at the exact solution y at t sub I plus some small interval, and for us that's h, the interval h. So we're looking at the exact solution at t sub I plus h. And Taylor's theorem says you can represent that in terms of the exact solution y at t sub I, the initial point, plus the interval h times the first derivative of the solution at t sub I with respect to t as the first term, plus h squared over 2 factorial over the second derivative, plus h cubed over 3 factorial times the third derivative, and so on. Each term is the interval or the small distance away from the point, h to the p power over p factorial times the p derivative of the function that we're interested in the solution. So if you remember back to the previous slide, we were saying that the solution that we were computing was for xi plus 1, we were calculating xi plus h times the first derivative function. We were representing the first derivative function as f sub tx. So here it would be f sub ty. So you can see that that's the first term plus the second term, h times the first derivative. And that's all we were using in Euler's equation. So there of all these remaining terms in Taylor's expansion of this quantity, the h squared over 2 factorial terms and so on. So that's the amount of the error, or an approximation of the amount of the error, as close as Taylor's theorem gets to representing this quantity. So if we look at it, it's characterized by the biggest term, which is of order h squared. And so people refer to all of these terms lumped together are basically are dominated by the h squared term times some constant, and that's called order h squared, big O of h squared. So we can represent the in the third equation there that the exact solution y sub ti plus h is equal to the numerical solution x sub ti plus h times the first derivative plus some error that's going to be of order h squared. So this says that we can estimate the error as being of order h squared over each interval little h. And that is what we discussed as the local error. That's the error over each interval. Now this accumulates over all the intervals. There's 1 over h intervals, and so the global error is of order h. And since this is of order h, this is called a first order method. Now on the next slide, I have another more detailed example of showing the error. Oh, whoops, I have one more slide in between. So on page 14, we want to discuss the relationship of this error to the form of computation that we're going to make. So far we kind of discussed that we're going to approximate this function over time, computing values, and we're estimating how much error we're going to get. But in truth, the computation that people want is they want an approximation to the function within some error. So actually, Euler's method, so there is a theorem, and one of the numerical analysis books that you can read about it in is called Burden and Fares, that whenever this function satisfies, the derivative function satisfies certain smoothness conditions, certain continuity conditions, you can always find a sufficiently small step size h, such that the difference between the real solution at ti and the approximation is less than some required error magnitude epsilon. So if you want to compute where your particles are within some error, say 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 6, then with these methods we can always find a small enough interval size h that we can compute the numerical solution within that error. Notice then that whether a method is practical or not depends on how many intervals we have to compute in order to get the required error, and the expensive part of the computation at each step, computing it for each interval, is the computation of the derivative function. So it's important in each method how many times we have to compute the derivative function at each step. Well, Euler's method is very simple. You compute the derivative function f one time at each step, and then you can find, but the problem is that Euler's method is said to be not practical because the number of steps that you have to have in order to produce the specified error is very large compared to some of the other methods. So the other methods overall, even though they may require more computation of f at a particular step size, they will have far fewer steps than Euler's method and overall will have less computation in order to produce the specified error. And so that's what people mean when they say that Euler's method isn't practical. Okay, so here's my example that's going to discuss to show just in a very simple way in a very tiny number of steps, namely four steps, what the error is in using Euler's approximation of a well-known function. So we're going to take an easy function. You can set up the problem. It's an initial value problem. You're solving for a quantity little y. The initial value at 0 is 1. And the first derivative, dy dt, is y itself. Now, this is actually has an analytical solution, and the function that it computes is e to the t. So we can check Euler's method by computing it for, in this case, a really big step size where h is equal to 0.25, and check and see what the difference is between the true solution, e to the t. So at each step, we're going to take the previous, to compute y I plus 1, we're going to take the previous value of y at I and add the step size, 0.25, times the first derivative function, and in this case, the first derivative function is itself, the first derivative function at y sub I, so that's y sub I, so we get y sub I plus 0.25 of y sub I. So let's calculate a few values of the approximation. y1 is equal to y0 plus 0.25 of y0. Notice that the initial value is 1, so that's 1.25. Then y2 is y1 plus 0.25 of y1, so that's 1.5625. And so on, we can calculate y3, y4, 1.9 and 2.4. And of course, this value of e is supposed to be something like 2.718 or something. So far we have a pretty big error. So even this crude computation, though, can display to us, can exhibit the properties that we claimed about the error for Euler's method. So here is a table that shows on the left the number of steps, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, then what the corresponding interval size would be. So that's 0.125 and so on. You can see the intervals there. The interval gets smaller, of course, as the number of steps gets bigger. Then we can use Euler's method, as we did on the previous slide, to calculate the value of y at the nth point. So we get these successively better approximations to e, 2.56, 2.63, and so on. But what we're really interested in is looking at the error, and if we take the absolute value of the approximation here, yn minus little yn minus e, this column next to the last column shows the error at the nth step. So this is the global error, because we know the exact solution in this simple case, and we can compare it with the approximated solution. But what's interesting is to check that this error is in fact of order h, as we predicted by our error analysis. So to do that, for each of these steps sizes, we take the error, the global error, absolute value of yn minus e, and divide by h, the step size, because the step size is different in each of these cases. And we get pretty much a constant, 1.2, 1.3, and so on, thus indicating that the error is of order h. That is, it's the error that you get is a constant times h in each of these cases. So, of course, this isn't a proof. It's a demonstration that this simple case fits the theory. So now we want to go on and discuss some other methods, and the next method we'll discuss is sometimes called a modified Euler's method, or sometimes called the midpoint method. It's another of the Taylor series or Runge-Kutta methods. So in this case, we are going to have do a more complex calculation that involves making a better guess of what the slope is of the interval between the initial value x0 and the next value x1, or in general between the value xi and xi plus 1. So in descriptive words, what we're going to do, remember for Euler's method, if you look at the diagram, we looked at the value, the initial point x0, and we calculated the derivative to find the slope. That's that red arrow, that first red arrow. In this case, and in Euler's method, we use that to compute our guess for what x1 was. But in this case, we're going to use that initial slope to, in a simple way, such as Euler's, to just linearly extrapolate and find the midpoint of the interval, not at the end, but in the midpoint. Then we're going to compute the derivative function at that point, at the midpoint, and use the midpoint derivative to extrapolate the function value at the next time step. So over on the left, right, so in the, wait a minute, so in the diagram on the right, we are computing the first derivative is this quantity delta 1 of the initial point of the interval. Then we're calculating this, the first derivative, call it delta 2, of the midpoint. And then we're using that slope times h to get the actual guess x1, the numerical approximation. So in terms of the equations that we'd write on the left there, again, we always have x0 as the initial value. Now we have these intermediate steps. Delta 1 is the derivative function, delta. Right, so now this equation is expressing how to find xi plus 1 in terms of xi. So the delta 1 quantity, which is the slope at the initial point, is, of course, the derivative f calculated at the initial point, ti xi. Then we want, then delta 2 is supposed to be the slope of the midpoint. So we calculate the derivative function f at ti plus a half h. That's the middle of that interval in the t direction. And what we calculated from delta 1 to extrapolate where the midpoint is in the x direction. So it's xi plus 1 half h, because it's half the interval, times delta 1. So that's the equation for delta 2. And then finally, we put it all together. We use the slope, delta 2, to extrapolate linearly to find the next guess, xi plus 1. So xi plus 1 is equal to xi plus h times delta 2. So if we analyze the error of this equation, it turns out that it does have global error of order h squared. And so people call it a second-order method. It has a better behaved error function than Euler's method. So now we can look at the error of the midpoint method that for the same example that we looked at before, where we know the solution E. And so this is the same number of iterations, 4 through 128. Here is the interval size, and, well, I'm sorry, the other case we computed 8 through 128, but here we have 4 through 128. The approximation yn, and notice that in 128 iterations, the approximation yn is approaching the solution within, and in the next column we have the error as 0.00027 for the value of the function in only 128 iterations or intervals. But also notice that the last column, that if we take it's getting dark here, so I notice my video is getting dark. Anyway, so in the last column, if we take the error, the difference between the approximation yn minus the solution that we know, which is E, absolute value, and divide it by h squared this time, we see that we get almost pretty much a constant in the last column, not quite as much as in the previous case, but pretty much showing that the error was h squared, that is, it was a constant times h squared. Now, one of the things I forgot to mention when we were showing this example originally was that I took this example from what's called the CSEP book, the computational science, I forget what the rest of it stands for, but it's an online book. It's not a printed book at all, but it's an online book that talks about the various computational methods. It really has, and it has additional example chapters, so it's quite a large book. Various authors have contributed to it with different chapters about these topics that are similar to the content of this course. So at the end, I'll show you where to find that book online if you want to read more in the chapter about solving ODEs. I think it's a good source, and it's very accessible since it's online. it still doesn't go into as much detail as a numerical analysis book would. And if you're really interested in pursuing the numerical methods, you would need to consult a numerical analysis book such as Burden and Fares. So now I'm going to go on to slide 19 and talk about the third of these methods, the classical Runge-Kutta method. And this is a practical method that scientists actually use to solve equations. And it achieves better results than either of those Euler methods by using intermediate computations, again, at intermediate points, but more so than the midpoint method. This is a fourth order method, that is, the error is of order h to the fourth. So it has good accuracy with modest computational complexity, that is, it's going to compute the derivative three times at each step, and it's going to achieve fourth order accuracy, so that's very good in terms of the amount of computation versus the error that you achieve. So here is the algorithm in words, in the yellow words at the bottom, from the middle onto the bottom of this slide. So it has the same form as the other methods. It's one of the Runge-Kutta methods. You start with the initial point of the interval. You use its derivative to get a trial midpoint, just the way we did with the midpoint method. But then we do go on to take that, the derivative at the midpoint, we use it back at the first time step to get a second trial midpoint. Whereas in the midpoint method, we use the derivative at the first time step to get the end result. So this is more complex. We use the first trial midpoint derivative at the first time set to get the second trial midpoint. Then we finally use its derivative to get a trial endpoint. And then we use Simpson's rule to integrate over those points using for the midpoint the average of two midpoint estimates to get a polynomial approximation of the curve over that interval described by the initial point, the average of the two midpoints and the trial endpoint to get a final endpoint value. So we're going to show this algorithm next in equations, and then we finally have it drawn in a diagram with the red slope arrows the way we did the others. So here are the equations. They may look a little daunting at first, but we start with x0, the initial value, as usual. Then we'll call delta 1 the derivative function f computed at the initial value of the interval, ti xi. Now we're going to compute the derivative function f at a trial midpoint. So the trial midpoint is defined by ti plus h over 2, which is the middle of the interval from ti to ti plus 1. And in the x direction, xi plus h over 2 times delta 1. So that uses the slope delta 1 to compute the trial value, a new trial midpoint. Ah, so how many people don't have this slide? Because it's hopeless for me to describe these equations if you can't see them. Do people in the lab have the slide? I think that's John that said he didn't have the slide. Does the JSU lab have the slide? This is the slide on page 20. So people in the lab at JSU have it. Do people in the lab at NPAC have it? Go back and forward. Okay. So this is unusual because other times when we've had trouble with slides downloading, John Eberly at CWIS always got the slide and everybody else didn't. Now everybody else has it except for John. Okay, John got the slide. Now this time I hope everybody else got it back. Oh, you're still waiting. I hope this didn't mess up. Well, we'll give it just a little bit to download here. It's hopeful if you've got at least some stripe of it. So some are done. Sully, do you have it in the lab? The Unpack lab? Okay, good. Okay, so I think a lot of people at least have this slide down. So these are the equations for the classical Runge-Kutta. It starts at the initial value, computes a delta 1, the slope at the initial point, the first derivative function. Then delta 2 is the first derivative function at the midpoint, defined by taking ti plus h over 2, and the xi value is the half the interval, h over 2, times the slope delta 1. So this is using the slope delta 1 at the initial position, xi, to compute the derivative function at the midpoint. So then delta 3 is we use delta 2 in the same fashion to compute a new trial midpoint. So delta 2 and delta 3 are the first derivative functions that compute the two trial midpoints. So now for delta 4, we use the function f, and something went wrong with the type font here. It's supposed to, f is supposed to be the same f as the other f's. It's just switched out of italics for some reason. So at the whole interval, so we compute now the first derivative at ti plus h and xi plus h times delta 3, we use the slope delta 3 to compute a trial endpoint. Now we use Simpson's rule, which in this simple case uses the slope delta 1 for the first point, use delta 4 at the end, and in the middle we take the average of the two midpoint slopes, delta 2 and delta 3, and if you compute out Simpson's rule where you're supposed to take one-third of the whole thing, except that you take half of the two endpoints, it turns out to be h over 6 times this whole thing. Plus, of course, x1, which gives us the new value at xi plus 1, the new approximation. So on page 21, we have the pictorial view of all of these things. It's kind of a complicated diagram. So from the initial value x1, we computed this slope. It's actually in blue this time, delta 1, which gave us our first trial midpoint. We computed its slope in red there, delta 2, giving our second trial midpoint. We computed its slope there in red, delta 3, and then we use that slope to compute the trial endpoint, which you can see over on the right, the white circle that has the red arrow, which is its slope, delta 4, and then we use the Simpson rule to compute the actual endpoint in blue here, which is the final value that we're supposed to compute. So this turns out to be quite a good rule with not too much computation for good error performance. So now just briefly, so those are the Runge-Kutta methods. Just briefly, I want to mention some of the other kinds of methods that are used. And we're going to then go on and do talk about how to set up the computation for a particle system using Runge-Kutta or one of the Euler methods. But let's just make a brief excursion here and talk about some of the other methods. This class of methods are called the predictor-corrector methods. So first, these methods achieve higher accuracy, better error, by involving an implicit equation. If you look at the second equation down at the bottom there, you'll notice that it has the form that it's saying what the new value, xi plus 1 is, in terms of, on the right-hand side, xi, h of course, and then computing the derivative function at xi, which we knew, but also xi plus 1, which is the thing we're trying to compute. So this is an implicit equation. It expresses the value of the term xi plus 1 in terms of itself. So this is not a directly computable equation the way an explicit equation would be, in which the value that you don't know, xi plus 1, is expressed in terms of known values, like xi. So the predictor-corrector method, on the other hand, the implicit equation has more accuracy. So this is an order n plus 1 equation. So how can we compute it? Well, we compute it with what's called a predictor-corrector method, where we use an explicit equation, that's the first equation, which has order n error, that computes a trial value x star of I plus 1 in terms of xi and other values. What's shown here is just Euler's equation, but in practice people use more complex ones. But you use an explicit equation to get a new value of xi plus 1 as a trial value. Now in the implicit equation that follows it, you use your trial value x star on the right-hand side, where you need a value of xi plus 1. So this improves the accuracy. In the case of this, which is just Euler's equation, we predict with an order h squared, and we correct with an order h cubed, yielding a higher order of error. So there are, in fact, some standard methods, which are predictor-corrector. They also tend to use what are known as multi-step methods, and that is they can also improve the accuracy of the approximation by not only using the first value of the interval, but using previous values from that. So actually the Runge-Kutta methods are known as one-step methods because you just use the one value xi to compute the value xi plus 1. In multi-step methods, you're at step xi, you're trying to compute xi plus 1, but not only might you use the value xi, but you might use xi minus 1, xi minus 2, previous known values. So this requires more storage, of course, because you have to store these previous values in order to save them and to use them in the computation. So a multi-step difference equation might have the form there in the middle, where not only is xi plus 1 computed in terms of some coefficients a times previous values, xi, xi minus 1, and so on, plus h, which is the step size, times some coefficients b times the first derivative function f computed at xi plus 1, which is implicit, plus the explicit things f at t, I, xi plus 1, and so on, back to the previous things. So in fact, if you didn't have in the second part where you're multiplying by h and computing the derivative equations f, if you didn't have a coefficient b sub m, if it were 0, then you wouldn't be using xi plus 1. You would be using previous values, and it would be an explicit equation. So those are sort of the two main ideas, which are the predictor-corrector idea and the multi-step idea. And it essentially, the multi-step allows you to have better approximations because you're not just taking these linear extrapolations. So the Runge-Kutta had a little bit of this because of the Simpson's rule. But in general, those methods were using linear extrapolation using the slopes, the deltas, to find either midpoints or endpoints. Whereas the multi-step methods can actually be fitting polynomials, which while they may not, which they won't be the form of the equation, because these are probably nonlinear equations, but they will approximate it better than those linear extrapolations. So here we have example of the kind of equations that are used. This is one called the Adams-Bashforth fourth order explicit method. And you can see that it's four step because it assumes you know x0, x1, x2, and x3 for the initial values. And then it computes xi plus 1 in terms of xi and the derivative function f at xi, tixi, ti minus 1, xi minus 1, and so on. And finally, there's an error term. There are these other computed constants as well. And finally, this error term, 251 over 720, times an error, which is of order h to the fifth times the fourth derivative. So the error term is of h to the fifth. Then here's an Adams-Moulton equation, which is fourth order. It's an implicit method, multi-step. It's a three-step method. And notice that its equation there, xi plus 1, is in terms of xi, but computing f at ti plus 1, xi plus 1, and so on. So one thing that you could do, notice that the even though these are both h to the fifth, the constant in the error term is much smaller in the Adams-Moulton. So one thing you could do is combine these. You can use Adams-Bashforth to be the explicit part, and you can use the Adams-Moulton implicit method to be the corrector part, the predictor corrector. So these are fairly complex equations, but they achieve quite high orders of accuracy. So that's all we're going to say about these various types of numerical methods for solving ODEs. And from here on, we're going to go back and talk about our particle system example and then set up this problem as a computational thing. So now that we've talked, let me just talk about a little bit here about going back to the example, solving the n-body equations of motion, such as you would for various kinds of things like the solar system and large particle systems. So again, we have these three vectors, capital X, which is the now we're changing notation here, it's the positions x1 through xn. Capital V, the velocity, which are the velocities v1 through vn, and capital bold A, the acceleration, which are these accelerations a1 through an. And we have our equation, the first order equation, dx over dt is the velocity, and then we have dv over dt is acceleration, the equation that we expressed before. So if we were going to have solved these equations using Euler's method, here is what it would look like. We would use Euler's method on each of these first-order equations, let's assume that we know some initial position, and then in order to find the positions x at t plus some, at the next time step, it would be x at the current time step t times plus h times the velocity, because the velocity is v is the derivative function of x. Then to find the velocity at the next time step, it's the velocity at the current time step t plus the interval size h times this function for computing acceleration, where let's call it grav of x of t. So this on the right-hand side of the acceleration equation, let's call it this function grav for gravity. So note here that I labels, so we're switching notation a little bit. I is now labeling the particles and not the time steps. So I think that this is, let me just check the next slide. I think that this is a good place to stop. Right, so we're going to go on and talk about setting up the n-body problem and how to compute it in a program and what are the issues for parallel computing. So that's the end of the lecture part. Did anybody think of any additional questions about using the VPL, or if you're not quite done with your homework while we were doing this? Oh, I had one more thing to show you. That's right. It's not. I take it back. It's not the end of the lecture. So I'm opening the shared browser on everybody's desktop, and it sounds like the opens are done. So I'm going to put in the URL of the class webpage and just point out to you where you can find this CSEP book if you want to, or on other resources. So I'm going to click on the resources link, and you should get up on the right-hand side a list of links for resources. And under general references, and we put the CSEP book there because it has resources about all the different topics, I'm going to click on that link. And this brings up a page where actually we only have one link here, which finally gets us to a page called Computational Science and Parallel Processing Training and Educational Materials Archive. So there are links to lots of stuff here, and if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see that one of the links goes to numerical ODE solvers and particle systems. And if you go there, the first thing listed is the lecture I was just talking about. And the second thing is the chapter on numerical methods for ODEs from the CSEP book. So if you want to read more about the numerical methods, then I recommend that. So that was what I wanted to show you in the shared browser. So please let me know if there are any questions, either about finding things in the resources, about VPL, we're going to be sending you emails soon about how to check your grades. So the question is, are we expected to write an exam on this material? And the answer, I believe, is no. There will be no exam. Primarily, your homeworks will be to use this in the computational, will be more programming type exercises. So we didn't really give you enough detail about all these numerical methods for you to do any kind of sort of analytical homework or to write an exam. But we're giving this as background so that you understand the kind of computation that's required to solve these kinds of problems. So in this course, it's computational science. You're not only supposed to look at programs and computational techniques, but to try to understand how these computational techniques are solving real scientific problems. Could you turn on my light? Just turn on my light. There, thank you. I came back to light. So I hope that you didn't feel discouraged by seeing all this mathematics. So if there's no more questions, we'll see you next Thursday. And we'll also be posting a second assignment using MPI soon. We'll also send email about that.